You're listening to KSKQ 89.5, Ashland, Oregon, community-supported radio. The name of the show is Your Brain in the Cybersex Jungle. My name is Gary Wilson. This show contains adult themes. Disclaimer time, Your Brain in the Cybersex Jungle is information only. It is not medical advice. If you need medical advice, please see your doctor. The central theme of the show is how internet pornography impacts young men and their experiences and the science behind it, which we'll be looking a little bit at today. You can visit yourbrainonporn.com for more information. Today we will have a guest. His name is Todd Becker. He's a blogger with interests in health, psychology, and self-improvement. He is a biochemical engineer with academic degrees in chemical engineering and philosophy of science from Brown, Stanford, and UC Davis. Blogging is his personal passion, and it's really not related to his job, he says. Now, Todd started this blog, which I love, called Getting Stronger, out of his personal experiences and research into the fascinating topics of hormesis, which, you know, he thinks is really powerful and vastly underrated principle in biology. Now, the blog weaves together science into an overarching practical philosophy that he calls hormetism. Now, this year, Todd is also going to be giving some talks at the Ancestral Health Society meeting and also Health Activators Conference in June. So, Todd, are you there?
I'm here, Gary.
As you know, on my site, we're dealing with a bunch of young men who have porn-related sexual problems or they have porn addiction, and we suggest, or they suggest to each other, that they give up masturbation and porn for quite a while to return their brains to normal so that they can experience pleasure once again and so that they can overcome some of these problems. Now, this is quite similar to your website, and both of us talk about dopamine and dopamine receptors. You talk about changing your set point or hedonic reversal. Could you briefly explain this concept and how voluntary stressors can perhaps reset the brain for more pleasure or more balance?
Yeah, no, and I agree. Our approaches to thinking about how the brain works are pretty similar. So, you know, stress is often thought of as a bad thing, right? We try to avoid it, and that's the message that we're always hearing. But there's some advantages, some good things about stress, and we evolved to adapt to stress and to deal with it. And in the right amount, it actually can be helpful. And specifically, there's a theory that was worked out by a guy named Richard Solomon at the University of Pennsylvania called the opponent process theory of emotion. Mm-hmm. And what he realized is that if we're experiencing something painful, our body tends to inhibit that by turning on some level of pleasure neurotransmitters. And the reverse is true. If we're experiencing too much pleasure, the brain tends to compensate for that by turning down the dial. And that's what's going on in addictions, where you have people who use, you know, alcohol or drugs or pornography and sex can have the same effect. It's so stimulating that your brain is trying to dampen it down. The problem is that you get all this pleasure, and then when you remove the pleasure, these inhibitory processes are still continuing on, and you feel down. And at the biochemical level, your body is down-regulating these receptors that take up the dopamine and give you that sense of pleasure. What Solomon figured out, he was looking at actually a completely different phenomenon, which is skydivers. You know, why is it that people jumping out of planes have this momentary fear and thrill, but then for hours after they land on the ground, they're feeling good? And he said, you know, this is kind of the opposite of addiction. Instead of exposing ourselves to a brief pleasure and then feeling down for a long period of time afterward, they're doing the opposite. They're giving themselves a lot of adrenaline, exposure to fear, something that they don't want to do, but they actually feel really good afterward. What fascinated me about his work is that this process progresses. So the way you get into an addiction is you experience this pleasure, and then the down, and then the next time there's a tolerance effect. You need more drug, or you need more exposure, I guess in the case of these porn addicts, to something more stimulating to get the same high, but you feel worse afterward, and the effect gets progressively worse, and you get into this addictive cycle. What you do with the opponent process theory is you reverse that, right? So you expose yourself to things that are uncomfortable, but are brief, and in my case, I found the most effective stressors are things like cold showers or going without meals for short periods of time, something we call intermittent fasting, or, you know, really intense exercise. And these things are unpleasant in the short term, but the body responds by actually upregulating your dopamine receptors, and you get this sustained good feeling that lasts, in my case, you know, and people I talk to, it can last the whole day or even longer. So you're basically taking the addictive process and reversing it.
The way you describe it is you're almost describing two levels. One is long-term increase in dopamine receptors, but since you're saying it lasts all day, that's almost like describing perhaps dopamine itself or other chemicals like opioids may raise and be sustained for a period of time. Do you think that's the case also?
Yeah, you're right. It's not, and it's not just dopamine. There's actually dozens of these neurotransmitters. The dopamine is the one that's been studied a lot, but there are other opioids, and there's even things like insulin that play into this. But the point is that these receptors actually form, as you know, these reward pathways, and they're throughout the brain, and they're even throughout the gut and even other parts of the body. I think the key is that they all respond the same way to excessive stimuli. They either turn themselves down, or when you deprive of the stimulus, they turn up. The key to me is, you know, so much of what's written about neurotransmitters focuses on these transient chemicals, like the dopamine, and those, they turn up, they turn down, they're momentary. To me, the much more important thing, and this affects your overall level of pleasure, happiness, or depression, and you know, as the downside of that, are the receptors. And the receptors are like the hardware, and the neurotransmitters are like the software. So what you want to do is, by engaging in these uncomfortable practices, increase the number of receptors, basically upgrade your hardware, so that you're feeling good all the time. And that way, even if your dopamine levels are not that high, you're still feeling good because the receptors are soaking in everything that they can get.
Yeah, many of the guys really struggle because they're not having pleasure in other things in their life. So what occurs is porn is the most pleasurable, quote, pleasurable thing, and so they're more attracted to it. Something that comes up a lot on my side, and the problem is it's the way my videos were set up. I talked a lot about dopamine and dopamine receptors, and there's a fear from guys that, oh my goodness, if I do anything that increases my dopamine, I'm going to interrupt my healing process. And I keep saying, no, no, there's a difference between natural activities that increase your dopamine or stressors and maybe addictive activities. Is that what you're also pointing towards?
Definitely. I think that the key is, and if you go back to the opponent process theory, by engaging in activities that are somewhat uncomfortable in the short term, you get a much more sustained type of pleasure. It's a very different kind of pleasure in the long term. It's much more long-lasting, whereas going for immediate pleasure through drugs or food or sex
or video games
this gives you this immediate pleasure, but you get this long-term down from it. So I think the key is to and it sounds paradoxical, and it might even sound painful, but if you find these natural activities, things like actually things that our ancestors were exposed to, you know, we didn't have central heating until the last few centuries. People bathed and swam in cold water. They engaged in a lot more exercise. I think even social engagement can be thought of in this way, because probably for a lot of these guys, reaching out socially to others is somewhat uncomfortable. But
yes,
the more you do it and expose yourself to that discomfort, the more you get the benefit of the long-lasting pleasure of social interaction.
So there's this another good stressor for you that leads to long-term benefits. Let's talk about some of the things you suggest. One is vigorous exercise, which many guys find beneficial. Now, are we talking aerobic, anaerobic, weightlifting? What's your thoughts?
Well, some of the studies, and again, this is an area where there's a lot of differing opinions, but most of the studies suggest that it isn't the sort of mild aerobic, you know, jogging or working on the treadmill, but something that's quite intense and takes you into that anaerobic area where you're, you know, really taxing your body's ability to consume oxygen. So, for example, lifting very heavy weights can have this benefit. If you do like to run, working in some periodic sprints or what they call interval training, really getting that heart rate up. And again, people have to be aware of their own physical limitations, but you can always find some way to push that limit. And it doesn't have to be for a lot of time. This can be 20 minutes of intense activity, but just taking a slow jog on the treadmill doesn't do it.
Well, that's too bad, because I like to take a slow jog on the treadmill. If I up it, my calf
muscles
don't like it.
There are benefits to mild aerobic exercise, but if you really want to get those dopamine receptors turning on, and not just dopamine receptors, insulin receptors, GLUT4 receptors that take up the glucose, these things have other health benefits like overcoming insulin resistance. And this requires, you know, intensity.
Another thing you discuss is cold showers. Tell us about that.
I think cold showers may be one of the most underrated and one of the most effective ways to activate your hormetic systems that I found. A lot of examples of hormesis take time. This is something that I think within a week you can realize big benefits. People, I think, have more fear of taking the cold shower than they actually find out turns out to be the case. It's kind of an unwarranted fear. The very first time you get into a cold shower, it's quite uncomfortable, and you just want to get right out. It might take a while, but the key here is, and again, this goes back to the opponent process, when you're exposing yourself to cold, you turn on a process called thermogenesis. Your body actually shivers a bit, and it's trying to counteract the cold. And there's receptors called nocioreceptors throughout your body that sense that cold, and they turn this process on. But it's not just a physical process, it's also a psychological process. And it does significantly upregulate the dopamine receptors. What you find with this is there's kind of an adaptation to it. You do it the first time, you're uncomfortable for several minutes, and then you start to feel this warming in your body. The next time you do it, you'll feel that cold shock for maybe less than a minute, and then you're feeling good. And when you get out of the shower, you have this glowing feeling. It's better than caffeine. You know, you're just up all day and feeling great. By the time you've done this for maybe a week, that uncomfortable period has shortened to maybe 10 or 15 seconds. And if you can stay in the shower, you know, 5 minutes, you're feeling great. This is something that you just have to try to experience. When I'm taking cold showers, and I take them every day, you know, I wouldn't go without it. It makes me feel great. One of the other things I noticed, Gary, is specifically it makes you more resilient to stress. So, you know, I used to get irritated or stressed out by small things. Taking the cold showers just seems to give you this buffer against stress.
Well, it's cold showers. I'm going to have to think about that one. But here's actually a quote from a guy who's using it from our website. Quote, I feel my will increasing each time I have one, and it gets easier and easier to jump in. I love it. These are fantastic. Just put in one limit at a time until your whole body is in. Jump up and down if you need to, whatever you need to do. Once my breathing slows down, the positive feelings are quite noticeable and make the whole day much better. So that's unquote. That's cold showers.
Yep, that's what it sounds like to me.
Okay, my wife has been trying to convince me to do it, but I have a rather I'm rather thin, and it makes me go into spasm. So I don't know. Maybe I'll start with cool showers.
That's fine, and I'm a big believer in gradualism. If you can't tolerate a certain level, first just get it cool. The key is, I think, getting down to 60 degrees Fahrenheit or less really is the key.
Okay.
Yeah.
And of course, there's one more besides exercise. And cold showers, another very popular one you describe, is intermittent fasting. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. One of the big reasons people do intermittent fasting is to lose weight, but it has a lot of other health benefits. And by intermittent fasting, I don't mean starving for days. What I mean is going for anywhere between 12 and 20 hours a day without eating. So confining your meal time to, say, a 5 to 12 hour period. And what that does is it allows your insulin levels to get low. It allows a number of processes to occur where your body starts to actually break down, some damaged components like damaged proteins in your body through a process called autophagy. But it also upregulates brain hormones like BDNF, which is brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And that stimulates pleasure, it stimulates attention, and it has a lot of health benefits psychologically, not just health-wise. It's something, again, I would get into gradually. I'd first look at cutting out, mid-morning snacks or mid-afternoon snacks, and really try to confine your eating to 3 meals a day. But then gradually you can get down to the point where you're eating 2 or even 1 meal a day, and which is what I do. I eat typically, 1 meal a day about 5 days a week, and then I'm a little bit more flexible on the weekends.
Well, that's very interesting. What do you think about people who do one day of fasting per week? Would that have the same effects?
Yeah, that's another way to do it. Again, the key is you're getting your insulin levels down. You're allowing your body to burn fat, start to generate ketones, and this BDNF, and it helps you psychologically to tolerate stress.
Yeah, I just want to make a point. I know some of our guys out there want to do anything to get well again, and I wouldn't want them to take either vigorous exercise or fasting to the extremes. What are your thoughts on that?
Exactly. Do it gradually. I have a post called Learning to Fast, which gives some tips on how to gradually approach this. I think it's a mistake to try to all of a sudden skip 2 meals, and if you're having problems with that, you've got to get into it gradually. But there's some tips, like certain foods that you can eat during the substitute snacks that will allow you to get there gradually.
A lot of the guys do report changing their diet and how that helps them stay off of porn. Many of them go towards their version of the paleo diet. Many go to low carbohydrate. But either way, all of them seem to be cutting out the modern crap that we eat, and that really helps them stay away from relapses. They find that if they go eat crappy meals on the weekend, that they just have severe cravings come Monday to go ahead and use porn. So this is not surprising.
Yeah, I think there's a commonality to cravings for food, cravings for sex, porn, drugs. It all comes back to the way the brain works. And certainly diet has a lot to do with it. But also, you can decondition yourself. You can learn not to respond to some of the cues that are turning on these cravings. And that gets into this whole area of what we call cue exposure therapy. I think that maybe some of your listeners might be interested in that.
That's where I'd like to go next, because that's a big deal. So could you get into that, please?
Yeah, well, where this really originated is some of the work that was done by Pavlov and others about 100 years ago. Some of it was done with animals, developing this whole behavioral set of treatments. And there's a great book by Pavlov called Conditioned Reflexes. And what amazed me, I actually went back and read the original. He was able to get dogs to not only stop salivating, but to leave a steak, placed in front of them and not eat it. And I thought, that's amazing. If you can train an animal like that to, ignore what would be sort of these very powerful urges, there's got to be something to that. And I kind of read about his techniques. And he had an early version of Q exposure therapy. The key is, and this is sometimes called response prevention therapy too, the key is all of our addictions or our urges, if you think about them and if you analyze them, they are preceded by some kind of cue in the environment. It could be, let's take the case of food, it could be an aroma or the sight of food. But it can also be a lot more subtle than that. It can be a time of day, a social situation. For me, I was finding that I was drinking alcohol more than I wanted to. It wasn't alcoholism, it was just that I was drinking, having a drink every day after work, and I thought, you know, I don't really need this. And I found that as I drove into my driveway, immediately I would have that kind of urge to have something to drink. And I thought, gee, why is it that it occurs then and not in the morning or at lunchtime? So your urges, if you analyze them, are always occurring in response to very specific cues. And I think that's probably the case with porn addiction, sex addiction. It doesn't happen all the time, right? It happens when you're alone or when you're in front of a computer. There's cues that precede it, and these can be very subtle. They can be quite varied. The key is not to avoid these cues, and that's, you know, the conventional thinking that's used, say, in Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcanon is, you know, you're an addict, you're always going to be an addict, you're always going to respond to these triggers, so just avoid them. That is one way to approach things, but you always leave yourself vulnerable because those cues can arise anytime, and then you're right back where you wanted. And even if you are very diligent, you can always relapse when you're just sort of randomly exposed to some cue that you haven't seen for a while. The key with cue exposure therapy is to analyze these cues, figure out what they are, and deliberately expose yourself to them, even the early ones that are kind of getting you down that road. So in my case, it was driving into my driveway or being in a certain social situation that would make me want to have a drink, right? But then you deliberately expose yourself to the cue and you avoid the response. You have some alternate response. Now, the way this was really worked out and where it's been successful is with drug addicts or smokers. So, for example, the smoker will be asked to handle a cigarette, or a drug addict, a heroin addict, will be given, you know, the needle or the drug paraphernalia and spend some time with it and then not do the activity. And first, often it's done under supervision in cases where there's a very powerful addiction, but you can do this yourself if you work it out. The key for me is, if you're going to do this, have an alternate response prepared.
Okay.
So let's say it's, take porn addiction. You're sitting there, you're in front of the computer, you're alone. You've already worked out that, oh, I'm going to go for a walk, or I'm going to call a friend, or some alternate activity that is pleasurable that you substitute for as the response. And one of the keys to make it successful, because there's a lot of ways this can fail, is you've got to do it frequently, and you've got to do it with a very realistic situation. You can't set up an artificial situation. You've got to actually expose yourself to the real situation. And third, you've got to vary the cue. So there's usually more than one cue that will set off the behavior. And you've got to expose yourself to these varied cues and have the alternate response ready to go.
So that sounds like a great suggestion. I know some guys are starting to use this with their own versions. For a porn user, I could see a cue as maybe putting in their favorite fetish into Google and searching it. And, of course, it'll give you a bunch of websites, but it doesn't mean you have to click on them.
Right.
Or old bookmarks. They probably shouldn't have those there. Or even, of course, sitting down at the computer or coming home after work. So they're going to have to decide what their major cues are, but you're saying to vary the cues so that you'll be ready for any of the cues.
Yes, and the other thing is,
we only have about a minute left.
Yes, think about the cues before you get to sitting down at the computer.
Okay.
Being alone, you know, time of day. Back it up a little bit and come up with responses to those preparatory cues.
Okay, well, that makes good sense. And guys have discussed it, like some of them have push-ups. So if they get triggered by something, which you're going to get triggered in this modern world, you cannot avoid sexual cues. They'll do 100 push-ups or they'll take a walk. So some of them are starting to get that that's important. But I think what you're saying is white-knuckling it just doesn't work for a lot of people.
No. The other thing is, if you combine the cue exposure therapy...
Okay, we only have about 10 seconds left.
Sure. So. Combine that with the vigorous exercise and the cold showers. That's the great combination.
Okay, Todd. Well, it's been great. It's Todd Becker from GettingStronger.org. Thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you, Gary.
Okay. Bye-bye.